Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, July 12th, 2023. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. University of Idaho says it will delay destroying King Road home where four University of Idaho students were murdered in November until at least Brian Koberger's trial in October. Also a change in accused murderer Brian Koberger's speedy trial clock. Hearst & Sons, which recently purchased seven mobile home parks in the Moscow area, is cutting down most of the trees in the park, depriving residents of necessary shade. Lawsuit against Idaho's new felony law against assisting underage persons to travel across state lines for abortion care without parental permission is filed. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report.
Programming on KRFP is supported in part by Idaho AFL-CIO, dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level.
KRFP is also sponsored by the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at PalouseFolk.org or on Facebook.
KRFP, Moscow.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The University of Idaho announced this afternoon they will delay demolition of the off-campus King Road House, where four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death in October. The owner of the six-bedroom rental house had given the property to the University of Idaho, and the university had earlier announced they would tear down the now boarded-up house later this summer. Last week, some of the families of the stabbing victims asked the university to delay the planned demolition of the King Road house where the murders occurred. The attorney for the Goncalves family said the university had disregarded the family's requests that the home remain standing until after Brian Koberger's trial. Attorney Shannon Gray told the Idaho Statesman last week the university asked for the family's opinions on the demolition and then proceeded to ignore those opinions and pursue their own self-interests. The home itself has enormous evidentiary value, as well as being the largest and one of the most important pieces of evidence in the case. University of Idaho President C. Scott Green wrote in a statement today, "We know that every action and decision around this horrific incident is painful and invokes emotions. That is why every decision we have made this far is with the families of the victims and our students in mind. While we look forward to removing this grim reminder of this tragedy, we feel holding until October is the right thing to do." The statement from the University of Idaho said remediation of the house, including lead and asbestos abatement, continues in preparation for demolition. Crews began work earlier this month to remove all personal items from the house, which was given to the university by the former owner. The university is working to make those items available discreetly and respectfully to the families in the coming weeks. The house has already been released by the court, and both the prosecution and defense attorneys have said they do not oppose destruction. Latah County District Court Judge John Judge Monday ordered a stay of Moscow quadruple murder suspect Brian Koberger's speedy trial clock as Koberger prepares to possibly contest his grand jury indictment. The court granted Koberger's defense team access to records and the transcript of grand jury proceedings, which led to his May indictment. In his order Monday, Judge said the court has already given the clerk's record and recordings of the grand jury proceedings to Koberger and his defense team, but the grand jury transcript won't be completed until Friday, July 21st. Latah County Prosecutor Bill Thompson is seeking the death penalty in the case. Koberger faces four counts of first-degree murder and one count of burglary for the November 13th stabbing murders of University of Idaho students Kaylee Goncalves, Madison Mogan, Zaina Kernodal, and Ethan Chapin at their shared King Road house in Moscow. Two people who lived with the people who were murdered survived. Koberger was arraigned in Latah County District Court in May, and the judge entered a not guilty plea on his behalf as Koberger stood silent through the proceedings. Jailers are holding Koberger in the Latah County Jail, awaiting his trial scheduled for October 2nd through November 12th. In his order Monday, Judge ordered a 37-day pause in the case so Koberger can decide whether to waive his right to a speedy trial. According to Idaho Code, an indictment against a defendant must be dismissed if the defendant is not brought to trial within 6 months of their arraignment. Judge said this is an important decision which should not be rushed, Judge wrote in his court order. Given these two important rights, the right to review and potentially challenge the grand jury and the rights to speedy trial, this court finds, and Koberger has agreed, that there is good cause to stay the running of the speedy trial clock for a set period of time. The stay will run from July 6, 2023 until August 1, 2023. At this time, the trial set to begin October 2, 2023 will not be moved out, but may be in the future if either party decides the extra 37 days are necessary to prepare for trial. The Daily News reports the 37-day pause will not halt any other portion of the case and only allows Koberger and his defense team time to obtain all the grand jury materials without having to waive Koberger's right to a speedy trial. Judge's order also stated Koberger was considered indigent and unable to pay any incurred expenses regarding obtaining the grand jury transcript, and those costs will be covered by Latah County. The Pacific Northwest advocacy group Legal Voice, the Northwest Abortion Access Fund, the Indigenous Idaho Alliance, and Idaho attorney Lourdes Matsumoto filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court yesterday challenging Idaho's so-called abortion trafficking law, the first law of its type in the nation, which makes it a felony for any adult to take a minor out of state for an abortion without parental consent. Any violation of the recently enacted law is punishable by 2 to 5 years in prison. The legislature passed House Bill 242 during this year's legislative session, and Governor Brad Little signed it. Republican Representative Barbara Ehart of Idaho Falls sponsored the bill. The bill amended Idaho's already existing abortion ban and defines abortion trafficking as when an adult who, with the intent to conceal an abortion from parents or guardian of a pregnant, unemancipated minor, either procures an abortion or obtains an abortion-inducing drug for the pregnant minor to use for an abortion by recruiting, harboring, or transporting the pregnant minor within the state. The law does not have any true exemptions and only provides an affirmative defense if the parents or guardians of the minor provided consent for the out-of-state abortion procedure. The Idaho Press reports the plaintiffs in the lawsuit contend the law violates the First and 14th Amendments and the right to travel within and between states. They also contend the law is vaguely written and violates the 14th Amendment's due process guarantee because it does not provide ordinary people fair notice of what conduct may violate the law. Democratic House Minority Leader Elena Rubel of Boise said the law, quote, is opening a terrifying Pandora's box. This is a real camel's nose under the tent of dangerous government overreach in areas that go beyond abortion. Regarding a person's right to travel, the lawsuit contends the law is so uncertain that plaintiffs cannot tell if it is criminal to operate a motor vehicle on the streets and highways of Idaho because a pregnant minor is in the car, and plaintiffs' own rights to travel are implicated and effectively chilled. The lawsuit asks the court to declare the law unconstitutional and stop Attorney General Raul Labrador from enforcing it. Legal Voice Senior Reproductive Health and Justice Counsel Wendy Heipt said in a written statement, Idaho's law is the first time a state has tried to criminalize the right to travel for health care. It is unconstitutional to forbid citizens from traveling because you disapprove of the reasons they are driving to another state. Idahoans, like all people, should be free to travel within and between states without the specter of prison, even if they are traveling for a reason other people disagree with. If this stands, what is next? Representative Ehart said she feels confident courts will uphold her law. Ehart said, "It's absolutely no surprise to me that a lawsuit would be filed by those who do not value the life of the preborn. This piece of legislation is a parental rights bill. The arguments I'm seeing, such as referencing the 14th and 1st Amendment, absolutely have nothing to do with this legislation. No one has a right to take a child without the permission of the parent to go anywhere. In layman's terms, we call that kidnapping." Matsumoto is an attorney who assists victims of domestic abuse and sexual violence in southwestern Idaho. The complaint says her work includes representing victims of sexual violence who become pregnant, and she now feels she is gagged by the law on what advice she can give to her clients. Matsumoto told the state's newsroom, "There's a lot of fear of what they even want to tell me. I have a little bit extra protection because as their attorney we have privilege, but it's still illegal potentially for me to tell them what they can do. It's still potentially illegal for me to direct them to programs out of state." Matsumoto says the law does not take into account complicated family situations where parents may be abusive or absent, or immigrant families, or situations where a minor lives in Idaho but the parents live in a different country. Matsumoto said, "We try to reach communities that have been traditionally marginalized, and those people are already afraid of law enforcement and seeking help. By the time those people reach out and trust one individual, one adult, that's a huge step. So if you are not able to be trusted, the whole community is going to go backwards, and they'll go back and tell their community it's not a safe place." According to the complaint, the fund's volunteers and staffers assisted 768 people in those states within the past year, and 166 of them were Idahoans, including minors. The third plaintiff is the Indigenous Idaho Alliance, a nonprofit organization led by Nez Perce tribe member Ty Simpson. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is supported in part by Idaho AFL-CIO, dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level.
KRFP is also sponsored by the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
KRFP, Moscow.
Residents of some of the six mobile home parks near Moscow that the investment firm Hearst and Sons recently purchased say the company is now cutting most of the trees in their communities. Hearst and Sons owns the land under Abiel, Appaloosa, Palouse Hills, Woodland Heights, Evergreen, and Blueberg mobile home parks. Residents of Abiel, Appaloosa, Palouse Hills, and Woodland Heights formed a mobile home community cooperative board earlier this year to look after their rights, and some residents believe the tree cutting is retaliation. In January, Hearst and Sons told residents to sign new leases and indicated in letters that their rents would be increasing by 40% to 50%. After organizing, most residents are refusing to sign the new leases. I spoke to Woodland Heights Mobile Home Park resident and member of the Mobile Home Community Cooperative Board, Susie James, this afternoon about the tree cutting situation this summer near their homes. Recent activity by Hearst and Sons since the cooperative board formed earlier this year, and specifically I heard about tree cutting in some of the mobile home parks, and I wanted to ask what the extent of this tree cutting that Hearst and Sons is doing.
Well, they're cutting down almost all the trees in the parks, I mean, without any explanation. We did confront them over at Avial Park, and one of the tenants there and myself, and he said they were cutting down any trees that were near the house, near houses overhanging, near the road overhanging houses, and they were leaving ones with birds in them. And she said, don't they all have birds? And he says, well, I mean, endangered species, but it turns out they cut those down too.
Right. And are there any endangered species in the parks?
Well, some of the residents there thought there was a red-tailed owl that lived in them, I think is what they said.
Uh-huh. So,
that's endangered.
So they're cutting down most of the trees in the Woodland Heights park that you live in, and Abia. Is this true for all four of the parks that Hearst and Sons recently purchased?
Yes, they are currently working in Abiel still. As far as I know, they're on the first loop. That park is large and has two loops, and they're still working in the first loop, cutting down all the trees there. I also confronted them a different time there, and he said they were only cutting dead trees, but that day they cut down live trees and left the dead trees. They have since cut the dead trees there that he pointed to. They left dead trees standing in my park, however.
Right, and the people you confronted were the contractors hired by Hearst and Son?
I don't think they're contractors. They're employees of Hearst and Son.
Oh, interesting.
They have, their trucks are labeled Hearst and Son. The tree trimming trucks are Hearst and Son. They're wearing Hearst and Son vests.
Right, and but they aren't trimming the trees. They're basically just cutting them down. Is there any possible reason that you could think that would be legitimate? It seems like they're cutting down the trees just to make the place a little less hospitable. It's going to be harder to air condition or your trailers,
yes,
for example.
I mean, that's the only reason I can really see that they would be doing that. They cut down a lot of trees that, you know, provided a great deal of shade to people's trailers. Now we're just kind of all out in the wide open. They didn't cut the trees all the way down. Some of them, they left like stumps sticking up. They didn't pull any of the stumps out of the ground. Now the trees in my park are actually starting to regrow out of the stumps.
Okay. And basically, what do you think the percentage of trees that they're cutting down is? It sounds like they're cutting down any tree that overhangs a mobile home, which would be actually useful for creating shade, but they're leaving a few out on the edge or something?
Yeah, in my park, they left all the ones that go along the highway. They didn't cut any of those down, and they also left the ones that are up on the eastern edge of the park, which is, you know, the far opposite edge of the park. There was one large tree at one of my neighbor's house, and I asked her, it was marked because they came in at some point and marked them for removal, I guess. And I asked her how come they didn't cut the tree down, and she said because they came and knocked on her door and asked her to move her car so they could trim a tree in front of her house, and she said, sure, it needs trimming. And she went back inside and came out several hours later, and the tree was gone, and she was shocked. And so the next day they came and knocked again and asked her to move her car, and she refused to move her car. So they just didn't cut that tree, and they never came back to take it out either. So that one's still there. But I would say overall, I mean, they cut down 80-85% of the trees in my park,
which is Woodland Heights, and they're currently cutting in Abiel. Have they gotten to Appaloosa or Palouse Hills yet?
They have done Appaloosa. They cut down most of their trees there as well. There's a couple people there. One of my friends lives there, and there's still a rope hanging in a tree dangling into his yard, and a dead tree beside it. I'm not sure why they never came back and finished that job.
Okay. Have there been any attempts to communicate with Hearst and Sons aside from the actual employees who are on the ground, like the office?
The only person that we have contact with is what they call the park manager. and he's been on site cutting these trees down, and we have communicated with him, and he just basically says, too bad, this is their job, and that's what they're doing.
Okay, and what's the reaction of the tenants that you represent on the community mobile home community cooperative board? How are they taking it, and what do they see as the motivation by Hurst and Sons?
Well, mostly we think they're retaliating against us, or they're trying to get rid of us. They know that we formed a cooperative. One poor guy out at Abiel actually got arrested for sitting on one of their tree trimming equipment. They called the police, and Hurst and Son called the police on him and said he tried to hit them. However, one of the neighbors nearby videotaped most of the situation, and he was just sitting there peacefully, not doing anything, refused to move. Nobody's really happy about it. I mean, the trees make the community, and you cut them out, and you know, you're kind of lacking a lot in the community when that happens.
Any other activity from Hurst and Sons since the cooperative board formed? I heard that you were planning or had already given notice to raise rents, and there is also a list of new rules. Can you give me an update on that? We really haven't covered the issue since March.
Well, they did hand out leases at somewhere around the beginning of the year, and the only indication of the rent increase was in that lease. They never actually gave us a notice. However, they're randomly choosing they give us monthly statements, and on the monthly statement it tells us how much we paid last month and how much is due this month, and they're randomly choosing who they're asking an increased amount of rent from. Nobody has received an actual notice of a rent increase yet. I was chatting with my neighbors. My statements keep coming with my same amount that I've always paid, whereas one of my neighbors, for a few months now, they've been asking him for an increased amount. It's $185 increase at our park that they want, and he's not paying it. He hasn't signed a lease with them. And another one of my neighbors called me last week and said that she got her statement finally, and they're asking her for the increased amount. Whereas mine still just says the normal amount. And throughout the park, that's the same situation that we're hearing everywhere, is that some people are getting notices asking for increased amounts, whereas others are still just getting the old amount statements. Nobody has received a notice of a rent increase.
So you see this as maybe a divide and conquer tactic? It's not like if not everybody's getting rent increases at the same time, then there are some people that might be fine with the situation with Hurst and Sons, whereas the people getting the rent increases would be the ones who would be organizing more, right?
You know, I don't, because I'm on the cooperative board and they know that I am. So, because they were notified once the board was formed of who the board members are and where we live. So it was sent to their corporate offices, as well as the property manager, park manager, whatever you call him. So they know who I am, but they're not asking, you know, they're not asking me anything extra for rent. So I thought that was kind of odd that I would be one of the people they would be targeting.
Yeah, maybe it's arbitrary. What's the situation with the new rules that are posted and the fact that Hurst and Sons is going to claim that people own fines if they don't follow the new rules? Is that situation progressing?
Well, again, that was from the lease that they gave us. They left them on our doors at the beginning of the year, and they haven't said anything to me or anyone in my park that I'm aware of about signing the new lease. However, some people have indicated that Hurst and Son, the workers, have said things to them about signing the lease, but we haven't heard anything at all. It's a 30-page lease. The lawyers have had a chance at Intermountain Fair Housing, has had a chance to look over the leases and found several things that are illegal within the lease. You know, they're telling us things like we're not allowed to have children's toys or play structures in our yards, and how long our guests can visit, and, you know, which is illegal for them to say that we can only have a guest visit for a couple hours. We're not allowed to leave our homes at night. We're not allowed to chat amongst each other, apparently. You know, I mean, there's just all sorts of things that are kind of outrageous.
So would you say most or all of the tenants at Woodland Heights are refusing to sign the new leases?
I would say most of them have refused, and I would say most of them at all of the parks have refused.
And that's because of your organizing?
I believe so, yes. There was a few people that signed the lease right away when they came out, including one of the members of our cooperative board, because they thought they had to, but then once they realized that we didn't, they joined in and have come along with us. So most everyone has been in touch with the Intermountain Fair Housing, which they have sent Hurst and Son, I believe, 3 letters. They're trying to educate them at this point. We have gotten no response from Hurst and Son, and the lawyers are sending them to the corporate offices, the addresses that we have for those, as well as the park manager that we have on record.
Okay, and I found out through one tenant of Evergreen, which is out, that direction. They have been purchased by Hurst and Sons as well.
So has Bluebird.
Bluebird,
which is over near Rose Tower.
Okay, and is the Mobile Home Community Cooperative Board getting those people organized as well?
That's our plan. We have to go out and go to their parks and knock on the doors and stuff. We just haven't set up a time and coordinated an event for that yet.
Okay. And anything that you could say about what else you're planning to do in light of the situation?
Well, at this point, Victoria O'Banion is in charge of the Rock Foundation, and she is the one the point of us forming a cooperative is so that we could eventually buy our own parks and we won't have to deal with Hurst and Son. And so she is the one who helped us get all legalized with the cooperative and stuff, because we're a legal entity now. And she recommends that we take care of all the legal proceedings and deal with that before we move forward with anything else. So Hurst and Son has been notified of the cooperative being formed. They've also been notified that we of our intent to purchase the parks. So we feel like we're kind of in limbo right now, just waiting to see what can happen between Hurst and Son and the attorneys. We may end up in court over this. Their attorneys have called me and contacted me, and as far as retaliation goes, they are prepared to take them to court if necessary, is what they have indicated to me.
Okay, and it sounds like retaliation is happening in certain cases.
Yeah, and also I did want to mention another incident that happened at my park. We're on a well out there as well as a sewage pond. We're not hooked up to the city because we're outside of the city limits. One night in the middle of the night, we figured around 11 o'clock at night, they came out the park and heavily chlorinated our water. We've never had any chlorination in our water previously, but when I got up in the morning and was showering, it was very, very overwhelming, worse than a city pool. I was like, what in the world's going on here? And then one of my neighbors contacted me, and she said, did you notice? And I was like, yeah. And she said, okay, what do we do? And I didn't know, but we called DEQ, as someone suggested. You know, I got online and was checking, and someone suggested we call the DEQ. So I did contact DEQ. That guy didn't really seem very concerned about it. He said that Hurst and Son told him that our water had a bad bacteria in it, and they had to shock treat it. And so they did. And that was that. And they never notified us that our water may have had a bad bacteria in it. and they never notified us that they were going to shock treat it, and we've not heard anything about that whole situation. So I don't know, you know, eventually it took about a week, but the chlorine in the water eventually faded away and they haven't done it again. But it was just kind of a weird situation of why in the world they, I mean, it was undrinkable. And to just wake up in the morning that way and not be able to, I have pets, not be able to feed my pets their water, you know, and she is the other girl that contacted me. She has a toddler and it was pregnant. She had her baby now, but, you know, she was very concerned about feeding it to her child. And I was like, no. So, you know, we had to make sure we had bottled water and stuff so we had water to drink. We had no notification of that.
And, Your allies in the various groups that are trying to help you legally, are they investigating that?
Yes. I spoke with the attorneys at the Intermountain Fair Housing about it about 2 weeks ago, and she said that she would get back to me on that. They were having a meeting later that day.
That was Woodland Heights Mobile Home Park resident Susie James. James is a member of the Mobile Home Community Cooperative Board organized by residents of Abiel, Appaloosa, Palouse Hills, and Woodland Heights Mobile Home Parks. In a decision yesterday, the North Latah County Highway District decided they would not go forward with a proposed rock pit at the intersection of Lamb and Driscoll Ridge Roads between Moscow and Troy after 40 residents voiced concerns in a public hearing in Moscow. The Daily News reports Krista Perkins and Richard Hansen proposed digging the rock pit. Perkins and Hansen said the proposed pit would be on Perkins' property, and it would provide gravel for the highway district, with Hansen saying at yesterday's meeting the rock pit would be in a central location and would sell rock to the county at a fair price. At yesterday's public hearing, nearly all the public comments were opposed to the rock pit proposal, except those made by Perkins and Hansen. Residents living near the proposed rock pit said it would impact their home values and livelihoods, and they cited worries of decreased property values, a dangerous increase in traffic, and said it would be a threat to drinking water in nearby wells. They also said it would cause health risks from construction dust, and the noise from explosions would impact horses and other livestock. According to North Latah County Highway District Commissioner Chuck Bond, the district also received several emails from residents detailing similar concerns with the project. Bond said they are all legitimate concerns and I agree with them. With little deliberation, the commissioners made the decision to not move forward with the rock pit. According to Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Fire Information Officer Jim Weimer, the Midnight Fire, a lightning-caused wildfire near Elk City Wagon Road in the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest, has now grown to around 350 acres. Weimer said the fire was around 15 to 20 acres yesterday morning, but a north wind pushed the fire between two previous old burns where it is consuming abundant subalpine fir. Weimer said a local Type 4 firefighting team is managing the blaze and three helicopters and 5 to 6 air tankers attacked the fire hard yesterday, along with smoke jumpers and several hand crews. Weimer said the fire is around a mile east of China Point and 3 miles northwest of Pilot Knob. He said besides the Pilot Knob lookout, no other structures are threatened by the fire. He said firefighting traffic is heavy in the area and a Type 3 firefighting team is expected to take over suppression efforts today. Weimer said the biggest impact is to the Elk City Wagon Road. I would fully anticipate some sort of closure happening on that road in the near future. The Lewiston Tribune reports another wildfire continues to burn near Jerry Johnson Hot Springs and could affect recreational activities in that area. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area. Partly cloudy tonight with a low of 54 and then clear skies at least through Monday, with highs of 83 tomorrow, 88 Friday, 93 Saturday, 97 on Sunday, and 87 on Monday. Lows will be 54 Thursday and Friday night, 57 Saturday night, and 60 on Sunday night. Currently 82. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Coming up next, Flashpoints, Lockdown Mosh Pit on at 7:30. And at 8:30, Grateful Dead Through the Decades with Arlene. And at 10 o'clock, our weekly musical, What's the Frequency, Kenneth. So stay tuned for more information, music, and entertainment throughout your evening here at KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse and 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Fiddler's Ridge Farm, a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving the Palouse since 1992. Two locations to serve you, 2730 Highway 95 South in Moscow and 1001 Fiddler's Ridge Loop in Potlatch, 208-875-1003.